Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
Hi, I'm sitting here talking to the one and only superstar, Bill Dundee. Hey, Bill. Hey, man, where am I talking to you? Are you right outside of Memphis, Tennessee right now?
Yeah, I'm in Germantown.
How did you end up over there after all these years, all the journeys from Scotland to Australia, and then all the time that I met you and worked with you in Tennessee? Did you end up where you're at?
Well, I lived in Hendersonville with a baby's mamas for 29 years before she got tired of me, so that kind of ex-nayed that. Then I gave it, tried it again, and so I lived in Lexington, Tennessee, and that didn't work out too good, so then I tried it again and lived in Memphis, so that didn't work out too good, so I'm trying it for a fourth time, and down here in Germantown.
Now, why did they run you out of Lexington? Well, was it the law or an ex-wife?
Ex-wife. Well, I guess they just left. You know how it goes. You've had a few of them in your day, right, or tried the relationships. I think the only difference between being married and just being together is a piece of paper.
Oh, yeah, I kind of agree with you. I tell you what, I certainly had a few go-rounds with the marriage divorce cycle myself, and it's easier said than done, especially when you come from the business that we come in, the business of pro wrestling, entertainment, whatever. So you got that much travel. You have that much travel, that much, God dang, distractions, let's call it. Anything can happen. It certainly doesn't make it easy, and the travel is what it is.
You want to buy your family nice things, but you have to be gone every day to do it. You know what I mean? You can't be home and make money, too. Not in our business, anyway.
Hey, well, what are you doing right now? Because last time I talked to you, about a week ago, and I heard you was back with the circus. Of course, you started in the circus way back in the day. So what are you back with Cobra the Circus?
We'll leave on the 18th of this month. I don't look to leave till about, the 27th of this month. Yeah, so I've actually signed back up to be going. Yeah, so I've got two more weeks. I'm sitting right this minute watching him play golf on the golf course. I live on the golf course right here at Germantown Country Club. Sounds exciting, don't it?
Yeah, Bill Dundee at a country club.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, you know what our country club was? With a cold kind of blood and driving up and down the road.
How did you? So what's your function within the circus?
The marketing director. Back in the good old days, I would look at the elephant handler. We looked after the elephants back when I did the Bullman Circus in Australia. But that was when I was 16 to 18, so now we do the marketing director. It's kind of like the wrestling business. You just say the word circus instead of wrestling. It's all the same thing. You try to get people to come to the show, sell tickets, give them away, do whatever, get the ads for radio, television, newspaper, TV, whatever it takes. And that's what we do. 9 months of the year, but I didn't go the first six. I'm only going the last three.
Well, how is being on the road these days after spending a lifetime on it? Because how long did your in-ring career last, Bill? Jesus, over 30 years?
Started in 1964, and I'm kind of still doing it.
So are you still getting in the ring and having matches?
Yeah, still pretty fair at it, too. I wouldn't say so myself. Now, do I do the stupidity that some of the kids do today? I watch or try to watch some of them wrestling shows, and do you think I'd know? I don't even attempt that. I mean, you know what I mean? The last time I was going to do that bombs away off the top rope, I climbed up onto the turnbuckle. And I looked out, and I thought, what am I doing? So I just climbed back down. I don't know what the people thought, but I didn't dive off, didn't do nothing stupid. I just climbed back down, hooked back up with a guy, said, let's go. So,
hey, but you know what? You've always ran your career like that. You never really took any – I mean, you probably took in your share of bumps that didn't feel so good, but you never went out of your way to take a crazy bump that was going to thrill or excite the crowd on a suicide mission. I mean, seems to me, in the times that I worked with you back in the day when I came in to Memphis, to Nashville in 90, and you were already an established veteran working on top with Lawler and other people, selling out houses, Mid-South Coliseum, among other things, but you've always been a guy that tried to learn how to work and tell a story in the ring and rely on getting over and using sound psychology in a hell of a damn match And also the business was perceived as being, you know, quote unquote, real back in, but you never took stupid bumps.
No. Bobby Shane booked me in with that way back in Australia. And when you came over and booked for Jim Barnett and me and George Barnes, just like all young kids were, for that era, was doing stupid stuff. And he come to me, he said, Bill, you only have so many bumps in your body, my man. He said, slow them down, and when you ever get somewhere where you're working on top and they mean something, then that's when you do them. You're trying to draw money. Just don't go out there and have fun with yourself taking silly bumps, because one day you'll land wrong and that'll be all she wrote. So I kind of learned that before I got here.
Yeah, you can't, it's real interesting. I don't know how much you keep in touch with today's current product, but, you know, Daniel Bryan is kind of a really, really good worker, but somewhat of a cruiserweight style worker, and a lot of high risk maneuvers, but puts his body in harm's way a lot. And now, you know, he finally worked his way up to the top of that WWE ladder and now sidelined with a neck injury. And he underwent his first surgery. He's fixing to go into a second surgery, I guess, in the next couple of months after that first one settles down. But, you know, my point is, and I say this with all due respect to Daniel Bryan, but when you put your body on the line, all of a sudden you get to your prime money-making years and you're on the sidelines. You know as well as I do, Bill, when you ain't working, you ain't getting paid. I don't know what the current system is, but back in our day, if you didn't work, you wasn't making no money. And if you wasn't making no money, it ain't like nobody's going to come over and hand you some groceries.
No, it was, you know, that's exactly what it was. So, I mean, and the guy I worked with most here, as you know, was Jerry Lawler. And he's a hell of a worker. And he didn't want to do all that silly stuff either. I mean, a flying head scissors and a drop kick was pretty big for what we did. Or you may take the backdrop over the top rope, but you're really not doing that. You're not landing on the floor. You're backing into the rope. The guy took you, hooked the top rope, and you take the bump from the apron to the floor. It's not like some of them today. They're landing on the floor. Well, look at old Bobby Eaton. There's another guy. High-risk maneuver way back when, before anybody else was doing it. Hell, he can hardly turn his neck. He can hardly walk. It's just catch it up where you wouldn't get to around 50.
Man, he's one of my favorites of all time, and it was your son-in-law. Or is he still your son-in-law?
Yeah, basically, I don't think we get along too good, but they're still technically married. Yeah,
but you know, the Midnight Express and him specifically, and I won my first TV title from him in Atlanta, Georgia, WCW. But is he pretty stove up right now? And I've heard he had a few heart issues as well.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, the lifestyle, you know, what we used to do back in the day, some people did more stuff than others, but drinking was probably the worst thing that we all did, whiskey, beer, whatever, and you have to slow that down. I mean, I'm 70 and still getting in the ring and doing a little, stay away 208 pounds of solid steel and sex appeal. You ask me and I'll tell you about it. But so, I mean, but I still enjoy what I do, but I will not work with an idiot. If I get to the show and I don't know anybody and say, hey, brother, have you seen my act? This is what we're going to do. And that's what we do. Nothing stupid. I don't try to hurt him, and I'm not having him hurt me.
But, dude, Bill, with all the years that you've been around, and you started, what, was it 62 or 64? 62?
Yeah, well, kind of 64 was basically when we're just getting going, 62. 64 was when Barnett came to Australia.
Right.
We did jobs for him.
And then you got noticed and working and putting guys over on television, and then Jarrett, right. Who was it? Jarrett noticed you and brought you over. But my question is, Bill, through everything you've seen, and, you know, back in the day when I came to USWA, you know, I was drinking a little bit of beer, and that was par for the course. I mean, pretty much, and this is a true story. In about every car, you know, the guys were drinking beer on the way to the next town, or on the way home, actually. You know, everything was one shot. I was based out of Nashville. But, you know, as the years went on, things escalated. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get introduced to, hey, there's a pill there, there's a drug here, this, that, whatever. You've seen, both of us have seen a lot of guys pass by the wayside. So what kept you, going so long? How were you able to resist the temptation? Or were you always just a, hey, say no to drugs guy? Because I know you'd have your drinks because I had a few beers with you. But now at 70 years of age, you've seen a lot of guys do a lot of stupid things.
Right. But I always was lucky enough to have an office job.
Right.
So when they were nursing the hangover or whatever it was they were doing, I had to be at the office. And then you go home and eat lunch, you get in your car and you drive to the town. Monday on Memphis was Monday night. Louisville Tuesday after night. Wednesday, Evansville. Thursday, once a month, Lexington Rock Arena or a spot show. Tupelo Friday, Jonesboro Saturday night, and Memphis TV Saturday morning, and Jackson on the way home something. So we never technically stopped. When I say we, Jerry Jarrett and Bill Dundee, because he didn't go to the town, I did. So we would lay everything out, do what we did, and Lawler would only come Memphis Monday and Louisville Tuesday, and then he kind of took off. So I was the workhorse of the stereo for a long time, just 24/7. And Eddie Marlin. So I didn't have time to do the other stuff. Now, I like to drink my beer and just like a car coming home like everybody else. But I never really, have I done stupid stuff? Yeah.
Yeah.
But not go on stupid stuff. Let's put it that way. I went to a party and somebody said, hey, do this. I have done it. Never did the pills. Never liked that kind of feeling. So, but the other stuff, white stuff, was sometimes you'd stay awake. But anyway.
Right, yeah. Right.
But no, I never, it never appealed to me to do that every day. And I've seen guys do it every day.
Yeah, and I have too. And it's, you know, and don't get me wrong, I've been around the horn and I talk very openly when I was living a little bit fast. But that was a short-lived period of time and I didn't see any long-term future in that. So, you know, I was always more kind of in a drinking crowd. Hey, one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about, Bill, because I was thinking about starting this conversation off. I was like, man, I'm talking to the superstar Bill Dundee, a guy who had a tremendous influence in my career. And, you know, I read your book, and I've got it right in front of me. Bill Dundee wrote a book probably about 2 years ago, and it says, if you don't want the answer, don't ask the question, is Bill Dundee's life story. And, man, through the career that you had, you know, back in the day, born in Scotland and ended up over in Australia, I always thought you were from Australia, but you've been a farmer, a cowboy, you joined the circus, you started training for, basically it was shoot fighting. Back in the day,
yeah.
Got in the business of pro wrestling, now back to the circus. And you've taught so many people how to work over the years. I remember that when I rolled into USWA territory, I guess the name had just changed, and Jerry had just brought Fritz out in Dallas. And I come rolling in, Mid-South Coliseum, and I was greener than grass. I'd been working 2 months, and it wasn't very long after that I started working with the superstar Bill Dundee himself. And I tell you what, you know the deal, Bill, because what are you? You're 5'7", you said, 209 pounds, twisted steel, right? Yeah. Sex appeal?
That's it.
Hey, you know, an idiot like me, and you've met a bunch like me, but I think I was a pretty good dude back in the day, but I come in ignorant, 6'1", 6'2", 250 pounds, former football player. I'm thinking, okay, I'm a lot bigger than this guy. You know, I shouldn't sell this or this, that, or whatever. And barely knew how to work a high spot. Chris Adams taught me how to bump, taught me about two wrestling holds, and the rest, as you know, is on the job training. And you were always very, very patient with me and very giving in the ring. And you always got yours, and you always stayed. Well, that's a testament to you staying over for over 30 years. But, dude, what goes through your mind when you get in there with a young crowbar like myself and it's like, okay, here we go again. I got to show this kid how it's done.
Don't get me wrong, the people, you had the biggest set of legs. When I say scared me, you never scared me to death. I said, if this big bastard falls on me, it'll just hurt accidentally.
Yeah.
I mean, you with solid muscle, what did you weigh, 250?
Yeah, give or take.
Yeah, and I was 208 at the best, 210 on the rethought I was a monster. So my 200-pound frame, and people say, wow, wrestling's this, wrestling's that. When your opponent that weighs you by 70 pounds and he just tackles your ass, it's very shattering. I mean, when we do the double knockout, whether you was going down or me, I got the worst of it because I was running into a brick wall.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, I got to be very gentle here and very careful. So you're just careful. But we didn't do stupid stuff. Yeah, was you a little clumsy than me on some things? Yeah, because you was trying to, you know, just getting going and things that we did, it was awkward to you, wasn't awkward to me. After 40 years of the business, you can go to somebody and say, hey, this is real easy. But when you start, you think to yourself, I'm never going to get this. And then one day it just hits you and off you go and you become a star someplace. And look at you, worldwide star. Did we think that would happen when you and come out of Dallas, Texas? No. We're this kid doesn't kill somebody, it'll be a wonder. But anyway, you made it and here we are.
Not just kill somebody in the ring, but kill a damn territory. Because, you know, back in the day, you know, we was going to the same towns every single week. It was the same towns over and over again. And that's the thing that I loved about breaking in that territory was you were forced to learn to work as soon as possible because you couldn't work, you know, like right now, the WWE, and I'm not speaking disparagingly, I'm just talking about today's system versus the other system. you're working that weekly territory. WWE is a giant loop, and you might be 30, 60, 90, 120 days from getting back to that next town or in close proximity. You had to change your matchup every single night of the week, and if you're in a program, you damn sure had to change it up every night of the week. So that really helped me get up to speed, was all those towns after another.
Right. And they were the same ones. Memphis was Monday, Louisville was Tuesday, Evansville, Indiana was Wednesday, Thursday once a month was Lexington in the Rupp Arena, Tupelo Friday, Jonesboro Saturday night, and sometimes a spot show here and there. So we was going to the same half a dozen towns, and everybody got rich. Jarrett got so friggin' rich, he built a 17,000-square-foot house.
I gotta ask you the question about the 17,000-square-foot house, because in your book, you talk about the big house on the hill. It caused a lot of heat within the territory. What was the story behind the big house?
Well, his mother said he had an illusion when he was building it. He told everybody, he said, I'm going to build a new house. Watch when you start making a few dollars. I mean, you've done it. You paid off your little one you had, then you moved to a bigger one. As we got more successful with the house, got bigger. That is a natural progression. Everybody does that. I start off in a little three-bedroom one with Jamie and his mother and his sister over in Hendersonville, in the poorest part of Hendersonville, and worked up to a bigger house on the hill up there. Nothing like Jarrett's, but just about a mile from him. So we had kind of got to the bottom of the hill. So he said he was going to build a house. And he designed it. You got to give the guy credit. He laid out the plans. He went to an architect. He drew the whole thing from go to woe. He designed the whole thing. And it just seemed like it got bigger every time he went to do something to it. And it ended up a monstrous thing. I mean, it was the actual part he has maybe lived in was 7,000 square feet. But his offices and his ballroom and all the things that was around it, you know, the house itself where the three bedrooms, the kitchen, the bathroom, whatever else, and that was about 7,000 or 8,000 square feet. So, you know, and as Jerry Lawler said, Bill, you built one wing of that, and I built the other, and Jack would get mad at you in the good old days if you said that, but now he'll make jokes about it. Say, hey, Lawler, he built that big house. So anyway, he sold it to a guy, and I think the guy went broke trying to pay for it. So he got his money back. He's happy. Everybody's happy, and we still talk.
But it did cause a rift because at that time, Jerry Lawler was a partner with Jerry Jarrett, and obviously he felt like he was getting not the short end of the stick, but the short side of the payoff.
Well, I think technically, we know how it was back in the day. They got the first bite of the apple. Well, this is where he kind of screwed up. He had a housewarming party, and he had Bobby Bear sing there, and he had the Nashville Symphony Orchestra come play the music. Country singers singing for him. His wife wanted the orchestra. He invited Lance Russell, Bill Dundee, Jerry Lawler, Stan and Steve, the Fabulous Ones, and I believe that was about all the rest of us. So when Lawler showed up, you could see the look on his face that he was pissed off. You see this house? Oh, yeah, I see it every day. I come to the office here. I live in it half as much as Jerry does in the office part. You know what I mean? That's where the office was. So that was when he went back and, I guess, put his little wheels to working, and him and Jarrett got together, they made another deal, and they become more big partners. But Jarrett Lawler never ended up with a 17,000 square foot house. But the one he has in Memphis now, but I think Vince bought that one, is pretty big. He has a nice place down here now.
Yeah, but it was a great story in the book because it was a real eye-opener for Jerry Jarrett. And a power play because Jerry Lawler was going to split off. Unless y'all could have a come-to-Jesus meeting and level out the playing field a little bit.
Right. And we went to TV that day, and nobody was there.
What happened? Lawler had everybody on hold?
Well, yeah, he had them all on hold. They were in Memphis. But the reason we knew about it, my daughter was dating Bobby.
Yep.
And you know Bobby. He's one of the nicest, country, honest people you'll ever be around.
Yep.
To a fault. And it was really a fault that he did this because Lawler said, don't talk to nobody till we get the meeting with Jarrett. Well, Bobby felt guilty, I guess, so he tells Donna. Donna tells her mother. So Beverly calls Jarrett and says, Jerry Lawler is going to take your territory. And Jerry just said, you don't have enough brains to take my territory. Okay, that was the start of that. So he talks to me. He says, you know anything going on? And I said, no, what's happening? He said, well, Beverly just called and said they're going to steal the territory from through him. I said, well, I don't know. So he started calling people, and nobody's... Anyway, all the boys showed up in Memphis. Lance and Jarrett and Jerry Lawler all had the meeting at the TV. They get the stuff all sorted out, who was getting who was getting what. Phil got the shaft as usual. I didn't get none of that on the part. They still worked. But anyway, that was all right. So they got together, they kissed, they made up. All the boys showed up, and it was Lawler, Jarrett, promotions.
I'm sitting here talking to the one and only superstar, Bill Dundee, a guy who had a tremendous impact on the career of Steve Austin, a guy who took me under his wing back in the day and gave me some psychology lessons and had great matches with me. I'm coming right back with more superstar after these messages from my sponsors.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey, man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
The Steve Austin Show.
The Steve Austin Show.
I'm returning with superstar Bill Dundee. Hey, you credited Bobby Shane with, saying, hey, man, the body's only got so many bumps in it. But it was at a time when you were, I can't remember what the territory was, but you said that Red Bastien and Mark Lewin really helped you as far as the psychology of working goes.
Yeah.
What were those guys able to teach you? What did they impress upon you?
Well, for the day and the era of what they thought I was little, Red Bastien was small compared to what came to Australia, courtesy of Kayla, Mark Lewin, Killer Kowalski, Waldo Von Erich, you know, that was the type of heels. And Red was a little bitty, not little bitty, I mean, I'm a little bitty for the rest of them. He was probably 5'10", 210 pounds, 215 at the most. And he would say, Bill, you can't go in there with the same thing that we just explained to you and let them big guys beat you around and drop elbows on you when, even though they're working, it takes a toll on you and do them silly bumps. I mean, if I slam a guy 250, it's a little hard for me to do that. He picks my little ass up and just throws me through the mat. And you've seen it done when people got power slammed, or, you know, Sid with Bad Ed, he'd pick you up by the feet and try to drive you through the mat. Power bomb thing. All that hurts when you're little. And that's what they said. Don't take the silly bumps and don't let people do it to you. So they were very good at that. And Mark Lewin, it was a sleeper hold, so there was nothing real dangerous in that. He shot you off to the ropes, whitening behind you, put you asleep, and that was it. So, but they took bumps when they were trying to do them, but they never did silly stuff.
But what was the secret to when you came over and started working with Jarrett, and you were putting the guys over in Australia, you come over, you end up in Tennessee, and your good buddy George Barnes comes in. You guys start off as a tag team. Now, George ended up getting homesick about 3 or 4 months in, and then goes back to Australia, right?
Right.
Okay, so then that leaves Bill Dundee by himself, and you're not the superstar yet. But explain to me what and Lawler had taken a hiatus. He was out of the territory when you and George came in. Y'all got over, and y'all got over big because y'all was a very physical tag team with a lot of intensity. But what is the key to you getting over in that territory at 5'7", 215 pounds, say, at the time, to get over like you did? Because, I mean, I watch TV today, and I watch a lot of guys struggle to get over. So I'm asking you what your secret was to getting over back in the day, being your size.
Okay. We got here, and George was probably 6 foot even and 225, 230 at his heaviest. He's usually between 225, 230. But he was 6 feet tall. I was 5'7 in my wrestling boots. Probably not 5'7 in the bare feet. Who knows? But anyway, I thought I was 6'8".
Yeah.
So, the very first time Christine Jarrett saw me, we walked into the office, and Nick Gullis had just built a brand new office up on 8th Avenue. They'd moved from the Sam Davis Hotel, and nobody told us. We got to the Sam Davis Hotel and went to see the wrestling office, and said, wrestling office, Nick, the offices of Nick Gullis and Roy Welsh. And we thought, wow, there's nobody here. The whole thing was cleaned out, so this old man at work elevator, you know, you see the movies and they have the elevator operator, the old man that works the elevator. They had one of them at the Sam Davis. So we went up to the thing, we come back, and we said, where did the wrestling go? Where's the wrestling? And this old man says to us, oh, he moved up onto 8th Avenue North. Well, we have no car. We've just arrived in Nashville. I said, where the hell is 8th Avenue North? He said, about 2 miles up there, 8th Avenue. You'll see it. Just go out there. So we walk up to the next Saran. We get up there, and here's this nice, beautiful office built in that part of town, and you could stew that like dog's balls. So, I mean, he has a fence around it. The doors are all locked. After we got to work for him, we knew why all this was the way it was. But anyway, we thought, why is he in jail here? Everything's locked. All the gates are locked. The doors are locked. So, anyway, we're yelling at people in the streets, but nobody's up. They don't know who we are. We're yelling at them to open the door. So Mike Duncan finally comes to the door and says, I hope you. Said, yeah, tell Nick Goulas the 2 hours you're here. So anyway, they bring us in. So when we walk into the room where you know, the meeting room, Christine Jarrett says, that little one needs to be a good guy.
Right.
He's still cute to be a heel. Well, they didn't know it's a bad guy. That Nick talked dirty and clean, and she called good and bad, no heels and baby faces. But anyway, so she says, he needs to be a good guy. He's too cute to be a bad guy. I said, no, Miss Christine, no, I'm a bad guy. I didn't want to be a baby face. You know, when you start, it's more fun being a heel. So anyway, she said, no, you definitely need to be a good guy. So we didn't see Jerry Jarrett for 2 weeks when we got here. We had to work for Nick. And oh, God, was that an experience. George Goulas and Nick, and that's my boy, Nick. You know, Nick would say, George, that's my boy. You look after him. You work with him. You look after him. And yeah, oh, God. Anyway, he worked with Harley Race in Nashville. And they went, well, it was about a 40-minute thing, a DQ or some goofed up finish. Harley had to go save George from the people because they wanted to beat up George. They knew he couldn't have beat Harley Race, and Harley did a job before people even thought about it back in them days.
Right.
So you get him back to the dressing room and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that was an experience. So they wanted me kind of baby face from day one, but I was George and he got over his heels, so they left me that. Then when George went home, Jared come to me and he says, we're switching your ass, whether you like it or not. Well, okay, what do you want me to do? So that's what we did. The interns come in with Ken Remy and beat up Eddie Marmon. And George and me had worked the program with Eddie and Tojo. So when I hit the ring to tell Ken not to do it, he pushed me and I nailed him and they jumped on me and Eddie came and saved me type thing. I got up, you know, it was done in Tennessee. So that was the start of Bill Dundee, just Bill Dundee, good guy. Now that was 1976. We brought Big Bad John in here, who had been a bad guy. Black outfits, black leather coat, steel helmet, everything he wore with Mark Lewin in Australia for 15 years.
Right.
So I knew him over there. So Jerry Jarrett, this being 1976, that's bicentennial year of America. And you know Jerry, well, he was very smart. So he comes and says to Big Bad John, we're going to switch you babyface. And John's like, well, I had a babyface. I'm a heel. He said, yeah, I know that. But we're going to put this little cute devil with you, and he's going to do all the seven and tag you, and you're going to come in and kick ass, and we're going to name you the Bicentennial Baby, and you're going to wear the big top hat, the red, white, and blue outfit, and all that stuff. So he said, what do you think? You're the boss. So on Memphis TV, the first week, we go down there, and so says, oh, we got Big Bad John here. He's now the Bicentennial Baby. Blah, 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 blah. So John comes out, they all talk like that back then. So anyway, he says, Lazarillo, if I'm going to be the Bicentennial Baby, this gentleman right here, Bill Dundee, is now Bill Superstar Dundee from this day on. And people just started calling me Bill Superstar Dundee because he said it on Memphis TV, and here we are 30 years later.
But so he gives you the nickname Superstar, and that's one of the, that's just a great name, Superstar Bill Dundee. And you know, obviously I have tremendous respect for you, so you got that going for you. You had a very solid work style inside the ring. And here's the thing, and I think you touched upon this a few minutes ago. You're 5'7", but you in your mind you're 6'8", and you didn't take any crap from nobody. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about your work. As a babyface, you had tremendous fire, which you have to have. You got to be able to sell. You got to have fire. You got to be able to work. As a heel, you had a mean streak. You're a cocky, arrogant, and that's money, especially kind of coming out of a 5'7" dynamo.
You have to have a mean streak, Steve, especially
yes, sir.
When you're smaller than everybody. You know how it is.
Yeah. Hey, when did you always have that tremendous work and punch. Because I go back to, you know, watching all of your work, but I love the battles between you and Lawler. We'll talk about Lawler a little bit, because you kind of go on record saying, hey, man, you know, if there's no Lawler, there's no Dundee. Because half of your career was Dundee and the other half was Lawler. And a pivotal part you guys each played in each other's careers in such a tremendous feud, lifelong feud, a 30-year feud. How did you get that working punch so damn crisp? Whether it was a left or right, you had that thing dialed in 24/7. And there's a lot of people, you watch the show today, and you don't see a whole lot of textbook badass working punches.
No, and Lawler had one too.
Yes. So,
but here was the thing, we cultivated them, I think, on each other, and we never really, what would we say, if we spotted one another, well, so be it. Nobody bitched, and nobody came back crying, and nobody, I mean, you know how it is when the million thing, you do the look on your face, you can tell when the guy's been spotted.
Yeah.
So you just... I just did it. I was always pretty good with the right hand, not so hot with the left, but I'm a southpaw anyway, so if I box you, I have a southpaw style, so I'm all right. And I have no real left. I couldn't knock you out with my left hand if I was to hit a 10-year-old kid. I just have no left. It's all right. And I think it was just that's how it was working too.
But how did you put together your style of work? Because, I mean, for a large part of your career was basically stand-up brawling, but you prided yourself in your wrestling skills, as evidenced by, you know, many of your matches with Tony Charles. You loved to wrestle, but a lot of your part was stand-up and brawl, and, you know, and a lot of that was Lawler because that's the way he worked. So what was the true Bill Dundee style? Because you could do it all. What did you prefer?
Oh, I think I really enjoyed the matches with Billy Robinson, Tony Charles, and the Les Thorntons and all the guys that could actually do that. That is a whole lot more. Me and Nick Bockwinkel, this is how you can get the people. I worked with Bockwinkel in Lexington, Kentucky, Rupp Arena, $17,000 house back in the good old days. That was a lot of people. We wrestled, this was the finish, we wrestled for 40 minutes. And we'd break, you know, you push the guy in the ropes, you'd step back and break, and he'd step back and break, and we'd shake hands, and we did all the things. The people forgot about Nick being half-ass heel.
Yes.
So we just wrestled and candle hold and wheel behind, take one another, damn covered up, blah, 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 everything. The finish was, at the time to go, I backed him back into the ropes, put my hands up and stepped back, and he went whack. Then I went 1, 2, 3, and we had a riot.
Yeah.
They were so much into enjoying the wrestling part, so they will, if you give it to them, they will buy it, and that was the finish. If you did that today, people would laugh at you.
Yeah,
or say,
yeah.
This will never work. But it will work if you have the people, if you're over and they're buying what you're selling, it will work.
You brought up the name of Billy Robinson, and I've got some Billy Robinson questions for you, because he was a guy that I was never around, never met him, didn't really even catch his body of work until literally, Bill, about 6-7 months ago, and I'm watching every single thing I can on YouTube on this guy. He was absolutely incredible and one of probably the best catch wrestlers of all time. And I also heard he was a bad stick of wood if, you know, he got you in the ring, and he was extremely tough. But God dang, what a worker, and I'm mad that I missed so much of his work. Tell me about your matches with him and also about him as a person.
Well, Billy was one of them guys that was actually a lot bigger than Billy looked.
Right.
You know, some guys are just, he wasn't, but he was a big guy. He was 6'2 or 3 and 245 or 250 in shape. He just never looked it until he was in the ring with him. You know, his hands and his wrists were thick. He had big hands and he could wrestle and he could have beat you anytime he felt like it.
Yeah.
But I would attack him like a little pit bull. I'm going behind you, Robinson. Me and him. Now, this is me and him having fun in the ring. I said, I'm going behind. And then he was, you know, here I would come. I ain't been there yet. He said, all that supporting back was the left, you know. And that was the kind of the joke with me and him. So, that's how he was. That's how good he was. He could be working and I could be shooting and I still haven't got behind him yet or took him down or did none of that stuff. And you know, it's just, yeah, he was an unbelievable worker, and he never had no problems working. They say Brett Lawson is the same way. He's a pretty tough MMA fighter, but he does favors for the guys in the wrestling business and no problem. Real tough guys don't have a problem because they know it's a work.
Right.
You know what I mean? So Billy was beating for the title, beating for the belt, or doing whatever. Okay, that's great. No problem. He had no problem doing nothing. And he was a hell of a worker, and just the way he would put holds on you, and get you out of them and do something, and people think, wow, that was great. But he did it all. Billy Joel, who was another one.
The thing about the, and you know, I remember when Steve Regal first came to WCW, and I think he was influenced by a lot of Billy Robinson's work, and that was half his shtick. And you know, back in the day when you worked with Steve Regal as Lord William, I mean, that was what Steve did for 70% of his matches, was put a lot of the green gas he was working with in holes, reverse them, put himself back in holes. It'd basically be Steve wrestling himself with the body of another person, and he'd make them look like $1 million. Now, back in the day, you guys could all work, but when you're working with a Billy Robinson, and probably to a large degree, the whole roster, there wasn't too much said in the ring other than here or there, a high spot, because it was all work. You fill in the gaps. Guy puts a hold on you, you reverse it, you start working that hold. With a Billy Robinson, was it the same thing? I mean, all of a sudden, this guy's just switching you in and out?
Yeah, and he knew, and it's a kind of like you just stay loose with him. I mean,
right.
Jerking your land or doing whatever, and then he takes a hammer lock on you, and he goes in behind you, and he drops over, rolls you from the hammer lock, spins around in front of your front face locks, and then looks like he's choking you. Yeah, you just go with him. It's a kind of like, you know, that. Well, you know how it works anyway. That's how it basically works, but most of them, they don't know what the wrestling part is. It's like you brought him up before, Daniel Bryan. He started down there with Danny Davis and OVW, and we had him in here with something else. That was his name when he was in here with Randy Hill, I think, in Pro or whatever it was. And he worked, yeah. And I like to watch him. He's one of the few that I actually watch today. Maybe it's the size, but anyway, he's very good at it. And he can do it. Just doesn't seem right, but he can do it.
Right. Hey, so what was the spark the beginning of what would become, you know, the Lawler-Dundee feud? And it seemed like every time I found a lot of you, a lot of your matches, and at the end of this interview, I'm going to give everybody these matches and some of the, you know, the Loser Leaves Town match. I mean, just an early match, a bunch of stuff that you guys did. But what was it about you and Lawler that was so intriguing?
We wasn't in love with one another. Did we have respect for one another's professionalism and what we did, both did in the ring, or what he did? And he was always a hell of a talker. So he wanted to be the big dog. Well, technically, he was the big dog. He was the king. I was the superstar. Kings have got to have a couple of points more than superstar. And he, yeah, you know what I mean? So he kind of lived like that. And I just said, okay, he's the top dog. I'm the next top dog. So, and we wasn't in love with one another. And Jerry Jarrett would kind of, he wouldn't fire us up at one another, but he would say, that damn Jerry Lawler said this, Bill Dundee, about your jacket or something. You know, then he would go along and say, Dundee think your crown sucks. Just silly little things like that. So you're going to the ring thinking, this son of a bitch don't like my jacket today. Oh, okay. You know, just, and he kept us a kind of, and there was a reason for that. Jimmy Hart told me that Jarrett told him this, I have to keep Lawler and Dundee apart, because if they ever got together and took the territory, they could take it. We never had enough brains to do that. Even when he went over to back to the thing, he never came and talked to me. He asked everybody except me. So I kind of asked him after, whether I said, well, why didn't you come and talk to me like you did everybody else? He said, well, you're Jarrett's boy. Yeah, but when you're talking about money and points in an office, that can change.
Right, right.
But I never got the chance to, so he just got the crew, and then me just figured, well, he'll stay with Jarrett. Well, yeah, I'd get mad at Jerry, and we'd do this, and do that, or say this, or say that. But if it hadn't been for Jerry Jarrett, my little ass would still be in Australia. Bobby Shane called him. He said, yeah, it's not the paperwork. We'll get him here. It took a year. And then me and Barnes showed up here, and he gave us a $600 a week down in Key back then. We thought that was a fortune.
Man, that was a fortune. I remember when I rolled into USWA in 90, man, I was making either $15 or $20 a night. And, you know, the drives. And that was probably actually overpaying me. when you cash your check at Evansville at the liquor store we used to cash them at, and you cash in a $69 check for the week, that's kind of living a little bit on the thin side. I used to call that place the Nutrisystem territory, because all the new guys that came lost weight because you couldn't afford to eat, and you knew where every buffet was in town.
Yeah, but look at the man that made you today. I know that we all say them story. I mean, when I did the circus way back in the grill, we never got rich either. They fed us, but we never had much money, but it makes you look what the dollar does for you.
Oh, no.
Let me tell you, Rich. I mean, Tommy, easy come, easy go, and it was like it's never going to end, but it does end.
Oh, I always go on record saying, and that's what I was making. And then I remember I went back to Texas to turn heel against Chris Adams. And when Jerry brought me back, he gave me a $100 a night guarantee. And that lasted for a couple of months. And the territory took a nosedive. And we went back to whatever it was that he could afford to pay me. But when I look back at those days, riding up and down the road with the guys that I was riding with and working with the people that I was, and, you know, that's almost. There's different periods of your career where you're just learning, and it's so fun because you always wanted to be a pro wrestler. And then you start to get kind of good at it, and then you're really enjoying that part of it. And then you kind of start making money, and that part's good too. So all phases, whether you're starving, learning, making money, or whatever, was a blast for me just because I love the business, and I'm sure it probably was the same for you.
Yeah. I mean, I used to go to the fairs back in the day because that was all the work too. And with the circus and on the fairs, and I went to Charmin's boxing troupe, and I was always a little cute devil. I mean, I looked like a girl, I guess, with long hair and a pretty face. But anyway, I would go and say, "Oh, that's a lot, big bastard." So I would stand in the crowd, and they would pick me, and I'd go in there and whoop the boy. And then when the people was actually paying at the Charmin troupe, they could never beat the guy. But they were working with me, and they were shooting Billy Robinson-type guy, was hooking with the big guys and taking them down, and they were losing their $2 back then. So, yeah, I did it. Never really made a lot of money, but it's good stuff to talk about today, and it's a good education.
Hey, I was watching some of your matches on YouTube, and I know you had several scaffold matches. Now, way back in the day, I think it was 1991 or two at the Great American Bash, I got booked in my one and only scaffold match with PN News and Terry Taylor. And Terry Taylor was a good worker. PN News, at close to 400 pounds, had no business on a scaffold. Bobby Eaton was also in this match, one of the greatest workers of all time and a super sweet guy. And then myself, and I got no business being on the scaffold. I'm not afraid of heights, but I don't love heights either. And then what they had done, Bill, they sent the wrong scaffold. So here's the reason, and Dave Meltzer called this the worst match of the year, worst worked match of the year. Well, when you got underneath the scaffold, they had sent the one where the tubes were so big, you couldn't wrap your hands around them, so that totally eliminated any kind of thing where you could hang from the scaffold and have a little jeopardy and some near catastrophes. We were relegated to staying on that platform. It sucked ass. We damn near killed the territory. But you've been in some great ones. In particular, I'm going to give out the time code to the scaffold match between Bill Dundee and Sweet Brown Sugar, which was actually Coco Beware before it turned into Coco. It was a 2 out of 3 falls. June 21st, 82, Mid-South Coliseum with the referee Jerry Calhoun. Well, my question is, I read when you first got in the circus, you were working with the elephants. But then also I hear that you were a trapeze artist. Watching the scaffold match, the way you're swinging from that damn scaffold, dude, there's a couple of high spots where I think, man, this dude's about to die. And then you start climbing the thing like a monkey. Y'all do a do-si-do, almost fall off. I mean, it was a hell of a damn scaffold match is what I'm saying. So how'd you feel on those things?
Well, let's rephrase the trapeze artist part. I did the elephants, then there was a guy who did it. I said, "Is that hard to learn?" He said, "Would you like to learn it?" This is Jules Bullen, one of the Bullen brothers. And he said, "They did it." I said, "Well, yeah, I'd like to get up there." So when you're up there, down on the ground looking up, it's like the scaffold. It doesn't look so high until you're up there looking down. So yes. I go on that little platform, and they showed me the thing where you bring your legs back behind you, and you let your hands go, and the catcher catches you. I did about 3 days of that. That was my trapeze thing. I said, "I don't think I want to be a trapeze artist. I just them somersaults and all them things." There's some things you know you can do, and some things you know you can't. So when the guy wrote that in the program in Memphis, he said, "Well, what did you do in the circus?" I said, "Well, I looked after the elephants, and I tried that for the trapeze." And I said, "The word is try it out." And he wrote trapeze artist. So being an artist means you can do it. And what I did, we were just learning.
Well, let's talk about the scaffold match with Sweet Brown Sugar for a second. Do you remember that match?
Yeah.
And y'all laid some pretty stiff kicks in on that thing, too. I mean, it was a great work. It was a damn good match. Did you like doing scaffold matches? Because, again, I'm not a fan. And you remember the big the one that they did in WCW where Road Warriors and Cornette took the long bump and blew his knees out.
Yeah, that was Dusty. He told Big Bubba, remember Big Bubba?
Yeah.
He passed away, you know, Bubba Rogers?
Yeah.
He told Jimmy, he said, "Well, Bubba will catch you."
Oh. You can't catch a 270-pound tub of lard falling off a scaffold. Bubba just run out of the way, and Jimmy hit the ground. You saw what happened. Blew his knee out or his ankle or something.
Well, you can't catch a human being at that kind of distance, much less 10 feet. I mean, you can kind of give him a cushion, but at that kind of distance, you'd be crazy to try to catch the guy. Ain't happening.
And you just can't. So that was that part. That should never have been enough, but Dusty, what he called it, the Night of the Skywalkers, and he kind of let everybody think it was his idea, which it wasn't. We had done 20, and then, you know how I got roped into doing the first one, that one with me and Pogo?
How?
Jerry Jarrett told me that him and Don Green had blown off a program with a scaffold match. I said, a scaffold match? He said, yeah, a scaffold match. I said, well, what did you do? He said, basically the same you do in the ring. He had backdrops and hip tosses and all kinds of things. So I said, no, you didn't do
this
that.
This is a great story.
He said, yeah, I did. Anyway, I have a tape of it. Somebody give me a video of it. That we're on a 6-foot ladder. 2 6-foot ladders and a plank across the top, and there was 2 guys holding the ladders. They never stood up. They sat on it and punched at one another. Don Green took the bump. He hung off and slid his feet down. His feet was 4 inches off the ground. Now, that was what... And I played it on the bus. You may have been there when we played it on the bus going to Dallas.
I read the book. I can't remember if I saw the tape or not, but I read in the book that after you played that tape, Jarrett wanted to duck to you for a couple of days.
Yeah, so I played the tape. I said, look, do y'all remember the scaffold match that Jerry said he did? Here it is. Somebody gave it to me. Oh, my God. He was the kind of man at the Superstar, but he got over it. He's shooting the bullshit. But anyway,
yeah,
you know how he was.
Hey, and watching so much of the matches that I watched, and of course, you know, going to TV there back in the day, and back in the day, that loop was, you know, Monday Memphis, Tuesday Louisville, Wednesday Evansville, Thursday Spot Show, and then get on a bus, drive to Dallas, and work Sportatorium Friday night, get back on a bus, drive to Memphis to work TV Saturday morning in Memphis, go get your car wherever you left it, go back to your hotel, take a shower, go to the Nashville Fairgrounds, work that Saturday night, maybe Sunday we was off. And watch, and that was the schedule. And then going to those Memphis TV tapings and watching all your matches back, listening to Lance Russell do the play-by-play, that guy was such a big part. And Dave Brown, to a degree, but really Lance Russell was the guy who was the glue in all of the chaos and the mayhem and the great stories you guys were telling over there. And the angles doing the play-by-play stuff. How important was Lance Russell in your mind?
To me, this is the two announcers that I like the best. Gordon Sully was the best at calling the actual wrestling, go behind, take him down, do whatever, take away the head, the body will follow, and all that kind of stuff. He was very good at doing that. But Lance Russell was the best at talking to a guy. Well, he thought for doing interviews. He said, when I got here, I started stammering like everybody else did, doing interviews on live Memphis TV. And Lance would pull the interview out of me and everybody else that couldn't really talk. Lawler always seemed like he was a good talker, but... You know, so, yeah, Lance was the best at doing that, and he came across as believable. What he said, you believe.
And another thing, you know, when he got a guy out there who completely couldn't talk, he would almost ask the guy questions and then answer them for him. It was a real art. And a guy was absolutely incredible. One of the things that I really enjoyed, and I'm going to give this time code at the end of the podcast as well, was it was one particular show that was dedicated to the Loser Leaves Town match. I guess it was the one in 83. Y'all basically spent all show, and it was y'all at the announce desk. You were beside Lance, and then it was Lance and Eddie Marlin and then Jerry Lawler. A lot of tension, and you guys are going back and forth and a couple of pull-aparts. And then there's another seated session where you guys are going through the paces and telling the story. You didn't give yourself credit in the beginning as a babyface promo, but as a heel promo, I really thought you were badass because you had that edge, you had that chip on your shoulder, and you were talking a lot of shit, and you were backing it up. And so I think your heel promos were outstanding. Don't you feel as a heel you talked a better promo than as a babyface?
Yeah, after when we kind of got going, but even in the heel ones at the beginning, Barnes did most of the talking and I would do the thing. And yeah, but here's the thing, and you know as well as I do, and I think it's kind of like a movie, more making a movie, I would imagine, I've never made one. But when I was a heel, I became this cocky little fella, Bill Dundee, and I believed in that cocky little fella, Bill Dundee, and that's what I portrayed to the people. But it wasn't really a work, that was me.
Right.
I mean, you know, I would fight them if somebody said, "You little son of a bitch, I'll kick your ass." I said, "You may, but you'll be in a fight. You'll know you've been in a fight when you wake up, whatever, the next day, because I ain't laying down." You know what I mean? So, yeah, that was how I was. I was a kind of a, like, I would have rather been a heel.
Right.
I'm 70 years old now, I'm like being a baby face. But when I was, you know, younger, I liked being the heel. And I really thought I could whoop baller. You know, so, I mean, I would think, if this ever got real, I believe I could whoop him. Never had a cross word with a man, never even came to look like coming to a real fight. But I believed in my head I could, and I think he believed in his head he could probably whoop me. We never had to find out. So I would talk just like that.
I'm sitting here talking to the one and only superstar, Bill Dundee. I'm coming right back with more superstar after these messages from my sponsors.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey, man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
Hi, I'm sitting here talking to the one and only superstar, Bill Dundee. You know, back in the day when you look at some of the, I used to have an old VHS tape, some of the old music videos you guys shot. And there was one showing you traveling down the road. It was done to a Willie Nelson song. I couldn't find that one. But, you know, Lawler had one, him driving around in a Rolls Royce and a Lincoln and doing his thing. But what was the genesis behind the idea of the Bad Reputation video? It was Joan Jett's song. And you're riding your black motorcycle. Y'all filmed it out there on Jarrett's property, I would imagine. And whose idea was it to put you on that motorcycle and film that video?
Well, technically, Bill, because I mean, I had rode the man. I had a motorcycle anyway, and I did that. So Jarrett were trying to bring out the heel. I was switching heel on that video.
Yeah.
So I was trying to get, you know, Joan Jett with a bad reputation with me because Lawler would make the interview and say, "Well, that's your problem, Dundee. You don't give a damn about your reputation." And he would go on with that thing. I said, "Well, that'd be great to make a video." So Jared says, "Come up to the house and we'll make one." And that's just what we did.
You know, I was reading your book and I enjoyed it very much. But one of the things, I called you the other day, I said, "Dang, Bill." I said, "I remember one time y'all were working, I guess it was Mid-South Coliseum, and you rode a motorcycle to ring, and I heard there was a big crash, and I never ever heard the story firsthand from you." I said, "Why didn't you put it in the book? I thought there were some legal ramifications." You go, "Oh, no, I must have just forgot it because I was excited about writing everything else." Break down the motorcycle story for me in detail so I know what happens.
Okay, this is exactly what happened. When Lawler first started doing the entrances, remember he came out of the ceiling one time, he came up out of the stage with a forklift that looked like he was coming up through the stage.
Through smoke, yeah.
Yeah, he was doing all that. So we were having a six-man tag, the Fabs, Lawler, and Dundee on one side, and Jimmy Hart and his family on the other. So Lawler wanted everybody to have an entrance, I mean Jarrett. So Lawler was coming in on the white horse. The Fabs was coming in with Fargo in the limo. And, of course, Marlon Brando wanted to ride his motorcycle. So I go to Jarrett and I said, "Hey, man, let me ride my motorcycle to the ring." He said, "I wouldn't let you ride a motorcycle to the ring if the business depended on it." He said, "You're crazy." I said, "No, man, we'll just do the thing." So I was supposed to be on Eddie Marlin's golf cart. We sprayed it the same color as that turquoise jumpsuit. I was going to stand on the back, and Mr. Coffey or somebody was going to drive it, and I was going to hold the cape out and be like Elvis and walk, be on the back of a golf cart, drive it down to the ring, step off, be in the ring, and that was Bill's entrance. The day we went to go get the golf cart, the battery was deader than Kelsey's doodads. He says, he calls me up, and he says, "Bill, I really have more sense than to do this, but take your motorcycle. And if the go-kart don't show up or we can't get it running, you can ride the motorcycle." Well, there's 10,000 people there. The Fabs have went in on the limo, down the go, the music.
And the Fabs were hot. The Fabs are going to get a good pop. They're really over at the time, right?
Yeah, okay.
Here you go.
Yeah. And Fargo and all had been in the ring, so Now I go, Jerry Jarrett said I went all the way to the back fence and was on one wheel when I passed him. Could have been, don't know. He said, your hair was blown at the back. You had to be doing 50. I said, no, man. But anyway, I told the man, do not turn on the spotlight. You know, when they're way up in the rafters and they hit the spotlight coming down the aisle.
Make you look like a big superstar.
A little bit for me, and don't make it dark and don't turn on the spotlight. Man agreed. I get to the, from the back of the fence into under the building. You know, when you went through the back door, there was a little ramp type thing. That's when the bike kind of jumped up on the back wheel. But anyway, we got up a little bit there and let it down, and he turns the freaking spotlight on. I can't see nothing. I went, oh, my God. So the floor, you know, at the Coliseum, was to get the condensation. The floor was a little damp. I touch the front brake to slow it down. That's what you carry on a motorcycle. Slow the front down, the back will come behind you. So I touch the front brake, and the front wheel slays up from under me.
Oh.
Bam. And we go in under the thing. And it's just a thump, boom. I went, oh, my God. It was dark. I picked the bike up, and when the lights went back on, I'm standing there holding the bike, and this girl is laying on the floor. So a lot of us coming in on the horse. So the guy comes to take the bike back. He pushes the bike back, and one of the security guards picks the body up. Now a lot of us coming in, and the people are going nuts. A little for seeing him, but an awful lot for seeing the body. So he's carrying this girl in his arms, and he's walking up, and I'm watching Lala. I'm in the ring. I'm as nervous as a whore in church. I'm watching Lala, and he's looking, and he sees the guy carrying the body, and he turns his whole head around. He looks at when she walks by the horse, and he looks all the way to the back, and I had to bring the horse down to the apron. He steps off, and he gets in the ring. He says, hell, Adam. I said, I think I run her over. He said, is she dead? I said, I don't know. I just go up in the ring here, and he picked her up, and he's taking her to the back. Said, did she move? You saw her. He said, well, no, she looked like she was kind of still in his arms there. So anyway, get to the back. And she survived, do all kinds of stuff. When we get there, I'm glad it didn't happen 10 years later because she would have owned the Coliseum and everything we all had. So she's back there. Everybody's around talking to her. We do the match. We come to the back. And Jarrett's real there talking to her. And Bobby Monroe was Jarrett's limo driver. So we're talking to the lady. All she wants is pictures. Oh, I'd like a picture of the fans. I'd like one of Bill. I'd like one of Lala. Jackie Fargo. Everybody would get a picture. So everybody gets the picture, signs them. We stand her up. Everything's good. She's about 20, 21 years old, I guess. And Bobby Monroe's there. Ma'am, you're not going to sue us, are you? I thought Jerry Jarrett was going to punch him. He went, Monroe, get the hell out of here. So Bobby leaves the thanks to the lady. Said, no, I wouldn't sue old Bill. He didn't mean to do it.
Jeez.
That was the story of the motorcycle.
God dang. Yeah, if that would have happened today, it would have been all over.
Oh, it'd been all she wrote. So, but she never just charmed her horse to her thigh a little bit.
Now, here's a question for you. When you and Jerry Lawler in the ring, okay, at various times, you're working heel, he's working baby. You're working baby, he's working heel. Two veterans in the ring. Who's calling that match?
Well, we just kind of did whatever. We'd work so often that you didn't really have to talk to one another. It was like we had whatever it was. We did the tackle deal where I'd tackle him and he would shoot up in the air. Then he did it for a finish one time. I went to dive through. He punched me and screwed me up, and then he followed drive me.
Yep.
Yeah. So we kind of knew by what the other guy was doing what he was going to get. But he got into doing a karate kick one time.
I don't know
where the hell he learned this. So he shoots me off and says, what's the kick? Well, I didn't know what he was. I was just watching the kick. So I'm coming off the rope. So he's trying to get his foot up to karate kick me in the face. I don't know what he got up there. But, oh, God, did it hurt. Boom, down I went and covered the thought. He would get the giggles. He was kind of laughing. That little hard, little stiff. I said, yeah, and I'll be the last one of them. So, you know, but that was, he was going to either, this fucking thinks this is getting over. He'll want to do this every night, and I can't take it every night. So, yeah, so that them kind of things. So then I did one. I was going to do the remember the Harley Race headbutt? He would stand up on the turnbuckle and fall forward and headbutt the guy. Well, I was going to do that one, only I was just going to do it a little different. I was just going to headbutt you as I was going through the air. So I tell him, watch the headbutt. So I slam him, boom, and he stands up. I get up on the turnbuckle, and he stands back up. So I just dive off and headbutt him. Bam! down he goes. And he gets by covering the top of him, and he said, that'll be the last one of them. So that was a little stiff. So we would try, you know, sometimes it would work good, and sometimes it wouldn't.
Hey, you know, when you were doing the Luthez press, I don't know what you called it, because maybe you got it from Luthez, but I stole it from you, or I borrowed it from you when I moved on to WCW, that thing where you jump up and just the guy, you know, yeah. It's a Luthez press is what I call it. But I got that from you. That was your contribution to my offense. And so thank you very much for that. Who taught you that?
Well, Jerry Jarrett gave it to Tommy Rich. Tommy was only 18 years old, and he had Tommy do it. And that's what it was called. He said, do the Luthez press. Talk. I don't know what the Luthez press is. So they showed him what it was, and that's when you jumped up, you boom, down you went. So when he went to Georgia for Barnett, I would do the thing off the dive off the second rope where you turn around and do the flying body press or that. But I never felt as comfortable doing that. It never seemed like I did it right. So I kind of quit doing that. But Tommy did it for a while before I did it, and Luthez did it all the time.
Hey, you said in a book, when Tommy Rich became was it your book or did I read it somewhere else? About Tommy Rich being the world champion was the worst thing that could have happened to him.
Well, yeah, they only let him keep it a week, didn't it?
Yeah. It kind of ruined his credibility.
I just never thought that would be, win something for a week, that, I just don't know.
Kind of ruined his credibility.
But he never bitched to me about it, but I don't think, you know, but he was making a lot of money.
Right.
Him and Buzz Sawyer, when they were doing their thing down there in Atlanta, Georgia for Barnett and Ole Anderson, they were on fire. They were going up north to Ohio, Cincinnati, and all them bigger towns up north off of Channel 17 TV and making lots of money.
Hey, how was your dealings with Ole Anderson? Did you deal much with Ole? Because he was always good to me. And he's a very, to me, talking to him is, or listening to him have a conversation, it's hilarious because the guy's so outspoken. Truly has a passion for the business, but he can be a little bit of a bully and a hardhead. So did you deal much with Ole back in the day?
Okay. They brought us down to Georgia. I was booking the Georgia end, Ronnie West and me, and I had Terry Taylor and Bobby Fulton as the Fantastics before Bobby and Tommy Rogers was. Terry Taylor was the first one because Terry was supposed to be one of the Fabs. And I'll get into that story in a minute. So I kind of felt bad for not that ever happening for Terry, so I made him one of the Fantastics, brought him to Atlanta, and we were doing Atlanta Towns and Atlanta TV, a TV in Chattanooga. It was just playing in Georgia. So Ole calls me up, and he says, can you send me the Fantastics? I said, yes, I can. You're technically famous, so I can. So he said, okay, thank you, to the Omni. So somebody called, I think Ron West called me back. He says, he has him booked against the Fantastics, the Road Warriors. You know, they were just starting.
Oh, yeah.
So I says to Bobby Fulton, Bobby, on no circumstance are you and Terry Taylor going to do a job for the Road Warriors in the Omni tonight. Anything but the 1-2-3. DQ, count out, anything. No finish. So we get down and you know, Bobby was, you've been around Bobby, he's kind of nervous anyway, smoking cigarettes. So they go over the finish. So Bobby's standing there and he says, Ole, this ain't me. This ain't Bobby Fulton, Terry Taylor. He says to Hawk and Animal. And this ain't us. This is our book, Bill Dundee. He's running the other end of the territory. And he says, no way are we doing a job for y'all tonight. And anyway, Ole gets on the phone because that's the whole. I knew the call was coming. It was off on the family night. Hey, you little son of a bitch, this Bobby Fulton, and he ain't going to put the Road Warriors over. I said, Ole, we're trying to draw money with that. That's the best team I got. We're kind of getting over on a little Mickey Mouse TV in Chattanooga because you've got the big Channel 17 one, but I can't send them down there to be job boys and then come back and tell them how great everybody is, blah, blah, blah. So if you're mad at anybody, be mad at me. That had nothing to do with them. He said, well, hell, maybe that was right, click. So that's why I saw him at the office. I've always got along good with him then when we were at WCW together. I bet you was there when he was there. And, you know, it was just, I got along good with him. But, yeah, he could be a little bit of a, Bully. And Bill Watts was another one. Just because they were big and kind of tough, they just thought that, you know, anybody below 6'2", they didn't think you'd be in the wrestling business.
Yeah, but you probably got along with Bill when you were down there booking for him. And I think it was 84, the 85 year, were Bill's two most profitable years. Well, I guess it was Mid-South still then, right? And you were booking. But then you didn't get so much see eye to eye with him, particularly when he was running WCW. That's when you came in and started working with Steve Regal. So how was it working with him when you were booking the territory? And did you have complete autonomy?
Well, 99.1% probably. This is how it worked with Watts. He came up here and he started, it was dead on its backside. It was just dead on its ass. All the big guys, Dusty Rhodes, Dickie Murdoch, Bill Watts in and out, Ernie Ladd, JYD, all monsters. So he comes up and he's telling Jerry Jarrett, he says, I need to get another booker and my territory's dead on its backside. He said, well, we have abundance of talent here, as you can see. You know, when Jarrett was on a roll, he would be, you know, Mr. Big Shot. He said, as you can see, we have abundance of talent here. He said, and if you need a booker, talk to that man right there, Bill Dundee. He may come book it for you. So he comes over, talks to me. We make the deal how much he thinks that we pay me or never nothing less than what we do. And I should have made a percentage deal, but nobody knew it was going to do what it did.
Right.
Anyway, I won't for the big money deal as well. $3,000 a week, that's a lot of money back then.
Yes, sir.
It's a lot of money now.
Yes, sir.
Nobody would pay me that now. But anyway, so that was the thing. And then some of the weeks was fours and fives and Ricky and Robert. So anyway, first night I go Little Rock at the Barton Coliseum, it is $9,500. Nobody in the building. Well, we get the rock and roll, you know, Ricky and Robert's DVD that would play here, the music videos.
Yes.
So we play them for 4 weeks on Louisiana television. We went back the next month to the Barton Coliseum, and it was $54,000, and it stayed that way about for the next couple of years, off and on. That was the best 2 years Bill Watts ever had, and he'll tell you that, but anyway, I would have to run it by him. I said, Bill, this is what I want to do, and this is why I want to do it. And I would have to sell it to him before I could even try it on television. He would say, well, why do you want to do that? I said, well, it's nothing really to do with the rest of it. I'm just going to hang him. I mean, you know what I mean? It would throw him, put the rope over your neck, throw him over the top rope. Well, Bill didn't do angles like that. He did more wrestling angles as far as, you know, without doing the gimmicks.
Right.
So anyway, he let me do it, and there were a couple other little things we did, and then the place was on fire. So, but even then, if I wanted to do anything too crazy, I'd have to explain it to Bill.
Did it catch Bill by surprise when the rock and roll caught on like they did? Because, you know, Bill's a big dude, a little bit of a bully, loved big guys in his territory.
Yeah.
The physical, rough, brutal, you know, pro wrestling. Like that, and then all of a sudden, you know, here's you. He comes to you for the book, and there you go, Rock and Roll Express, two good-looking white meat baby face who can work her ass off, great fire, sell like a sumbitch, and they get over bigger than Dallas. Did it catch him by surprise? Because you, in your book, I mean, you're like, he had a bunch of big rugged hills. Some of them had some heat, but didn't have a whole bunch of good-looking baby faces. Got to bring somebody in that the females can identify with.
Right. Magnum T.A. was the best baby face he had there, or the most looking baby face.
Yes.
And Ernie was making him do jobs every night. See, when I first went to Houston, Bill said, just come to Houston and walk around. Don't tell nobody who you are. If they know you, someone will know and some won't. Don't tell them. You just say you're in the neighborhood. You come by. Watch what's going on. So I flew to Houston, walked around the dressing room, talked to some of the guys. They know you. And then I never told him I was talking to Bill about a job. And I said, hey, come by, see the show. So I watched the show. So then he calls me, what did you think? I said, well, all the matches are the same. What do you mean by that? I said, they're all big lumbering sons of bitches, and they're all sucking. You know, and I said, well, you asked me, and I'm telling you. I said, well, what do you suggest? You know, and so we do the thing, the Ricky and Robert, and he saw him work. So when he came up for the inspection, I mean, the Fabs were the number one tag team. That's why we didn't get them.
Right.
The plan was if we take the rock and roll and they don't get over, and then the Fabs is another 3 months in Memphis, and we can switch them, the bigger, you know, the more mature-looking guys will get over and blah, blah, blah. That was the plan of that part. So we took Ricky and Robert, never thinking they were going to set the place on fire, but they did, and so we never had to bring the Fabs in.
Right.
So Ricky and Robert, then Dusty saw them. Oh, man, that was another story. And I know the world champion, he's the world's champion. He was Crockett's boy and all the things. But when he would come to the Superdome on the big show, you don't think he went back and told Jimmy Crockett and Dusty Rhodes who was over the best in Louisiana and who they were?
Right.
Ricky and Robert, the Midnight Express. So, you know, it was just, and here's the other thing. I've always thought like this, and it may be a little egotistical, or maybe it ain't, I don't know. The puppet only dances as good as the puppeteer. If you don't know what to do with them little fellas, they don't do nothing.
Right.
So I knew what to do with them because I'm little. And I knew what how to sell and what blah, 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 and what worked and what didn't work. So, you know, it all has to start at the back. You know that. If the guy in the back is not paying attention, whatever happens in the ring ain't happening.
Right.
And that's what's happening today. So that people start wrestling companies and they say, oh, I'm the booker. Okay, where do you draw any money? Well, you're just being here. You know, you're in little Dyersburg, Arkansas, so, and that's all the guy's been, but he's the booker. You know what I mean? It's all different. And you hate to knock the kids today because it's monkey see, monkey do, and they see Vince's stuff, but that's not what happens in the little towns. You know that.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, Bill, it was an interesting part. While you were down there in Tennessee, Jarrett decides, oh, did he take the book from you or Jerry, but he gives the book to Robert Fuller. Robert Fuller starts bringing his end of the guys into Nashville, and the territory takes about a six-month dive. So you guys need to do something to revitalize this thing, shoot a hot shot angle, which ends up being the big-ass concession stand brawl at Tupelo, Mississippi. How down was the territory? Was it in that bad of a shape? And obviously, the concession stand brawl worked. Take me through this period of time.
Okay. Buddy Fuller was Jerry Jarrett's partner.
Yep.
And that was Roy Welsh's son. Robert and Ron Fuller is Buddy's sons. So Buddy said, I'd like to take a little interest more in helping run the territory, blah, 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 when they got away from Nick. He said, well, okay. So he's bringing his son into the movie. Well, Robert... He had wild ideas. He had Toru Tanaka against the Mongolian Stomper in a main event in Memphis. Two monsters. Memphis had never seen that type of thing and didn't really like it. I mean, he says, oh, them two big bulls hooking up and there. Well, it was unexciting. In Robert's head, it seemed like it was better than it really was in real life. So he had about a month of that, and it started going down and blah, blah, blah. So Jerry and Buddy had a little meeting, and I remember it was at the office. He said, well, Buddy, do you want to tell Robert, or do you want me to tell him? He said, no, I brought him in here, and it's not working, and we're losing money, and he's going back to Knoxville. So anyway, he went back with his brother to Knoxville, and he took half the crew with him. So now we have Wayne Ferris and Larry Latham as the Blonde Bombers.
Yep.
Sergeant Danny Davis is the manager. We're going to Tupelo, Mississippi, and we're shot everything in Memphis, so now we're getting this bright idea. We have Lance full-time that can do the talking because he's not working for the TV station no more. He's working for Jerry Jarrett Promotions, so he can go anywhere and make TV. So we're going to Tupelo. We're going to do the tag team match, and they're going to screw us out of the belts. And when they screw us out of the belts, we're going to get into a fight with them, juice and all the things after, and blah, 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 and we're going to take that. That's great. So... like 100 times before, we've done the big fight and did the things, and we get going, and blah, blah, blah. The heels run to the back. Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee is chasing them. They jump over into the concession stand. Well, we jump over into the concession stand. So now you're there. Look at Lawler, and he's tired, and I said, what do you now? He said, I don't know, but this may work. So he picks up a jar of pickles, and he just throws him at his cousin, Wayne Ferris. And I don't think he cared whether it hit him or not because they weren't in love with one another. But anyway, he ducks it, hits the wall, bam, now it's on. They pick something up and throw it back at us. And if you watch the tape, you can see the people that under Herman Sheffield and his wife, they're picking stuff up and running out of the damn concession stand with it and trying to save candy bars and whatever else they can. We have a hell of a fight going. So we're slipping and sliding, the floors are kind of wet, and we're falling down as much as we're standing up, but it's exciting.
Are you telling me the concession stand brawl in Tupelo was a work shoot, but it was not necessarily quote-unquote planned? Yeah. Shit happened once you got there, and y'all just worked on the fly.
Right, technically. well, we a punch here, a punch, yeah. If we got over there, then we got into a fight, good. If
right.
we didn't, that type of thing. So when Lawler threw the pickles, the people went, whoa! And you can feel it when it's happening.
Yeah,
you know, when you've
right.
been in that, you've been, and you feel it, oh my God, this is going to be unreal. And then Lance had shut the camera down. So you can hear him talking to Mike Shields. He was the camera operator. He said, Mike, are you filming this? There's a hell of a fight going on downstairs. And they only had one camera. And so Mike has to get the camera and get it on his shoulder or whatever, and point it downstairs and then film this whole damn thing. And Lance's commentator, come on, Mike, damn, get it. There's a hell of a fight. And he's got strong words for Memphis TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Hell of a fight, you know, back in the day. And damn. So we're falling down and fighting, doing all the things that we're doing. So then here comes Jerry Jarrett. He jumps over into the melee and he says, come on, you go, quit fighting. So somebody nails him and he takes a bump. So once we got it going, everybody just started working.
Right.
You know what I mean? So they tear Jerry's clothes off, they tear his shirt off. They just brutally demolished this guy's suit he had on. He just tear it in like a real fight thing. Anyway, he escaped with his life type thing. When we fight, so then Eddie Marvin comes in and says, come on, get out of here. And Jerry gets me and Lawler out, and the heels are still in the thing, and Jerry's lying on the floor with clothes ripped off. So that was how we went off the air. But the thing that sold the mess was Lance had said, okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Good night from the Tupelo Arena. See you next week. Da, da, da. Close the show. Then you hear his voice black on the television. Oh, damn, Mike, we're going, well, hell of a, and it, well, I just said, he starts it all up again, and the camera looks like it comes back on and all that type of stuff, and here we go. Was it laid out? Not exactly all what happened. Did we know if we go over there, that's what they were going to do technically? But if it worked, it worked, and it didn't, but it worked.
But let's bring it back to today's current day wrestling, because you said something about Lance Russell's language, which that was a little bit strong for TV back in that day. And basically, when you go back to the old television tapings there in Memphis, that whole show from, man, for years and years, and when I was passing through there, certainly, in regards to language, that was a PG territory. Nobody was cussing, carrying on. And don't get me wrong, there's lots of blood and blade jobs, but take that out of the equation, y'all had a badass show. So My point is, I mean, this logic or this style of booking could still be, you know, a part of today's wrestling landscape, because y'all won't do anything crazy. You're just telling stories, but you presented it in a serious shoot style fashion. Now, many people knew the business was a work back then. Obviously, everybody knows it's a work these days. But my point is, man, if you just present wrestling from a serious standpoint, or that's your basis, is, hey, you know, everybody knows it's a work, but you present a serious project, a product, and not everybody's laughing and giggling and a bunch of BS storylines, that still works today.
Right. So, it's hard to do this in the rest of, but I have done this just for my entertainment and fun even today. Say I'm with a wrestling student that nobody knows, and we're sitting in McDonald's. You're sitting there talking to him, and then you do something stupid, and you just snatch him up and do a heel. You son of a bitch, I'll beat him, and just pull him up by the shirt and look like you're going to knock his ass out. Everybody in the store will go, oh, my God, because they think it's real. See what I'm saying?
Right.
And it can be done that way on TV. I mean, we, like I said before, when Lawler put the crown on, he really thought he was the king. And I put that suit on, I thought I was the second coming of Elvis. So we was a superstar and the king.
Yeah.
And we believed. So what we were saying, we was convincing people to believe it. But I try to watch them today, and some of the interviews are just, that's exactly what they are. I don't know how they do it up there. Some people say they're bugged in the rear or this or that. You've been there. You'd know better than me. But if you let you be yourself.
Well, you know, that was one of the things you just hit on. When Jerry thought I was a king, you thought you was a superstar. I thought I was stone cold. I believed it 100%. So, I'm not going to be critical of today's product, but I feel for the guys, because the guys are missing out. You know, when you can go out there and just ad lib a promo, and you're learning how to work, and all of a sudden you learn how to carry an angle, and it's dependent upon you without somebody just telling you every little thing to do and say, it takes you out of the zone because you can't freelance and be as spontaneous as it would happen, almost like a shoot. And so I just feel that organic nature is missing from today's product, which would, I think, make it a better product. But again, not to harp on today's system, I still love the business, but I just hearken back to those days when things were so much more simple, because human psychology and basics, good and bad, are not any different.
Right, and that's what we had in Memphis. We had good versus evil, and the people knew who the good was and they knew who the evil was. So if we switched roles with me and Mala, they would think Dundee was the bad guy, whatever, Mala the good guy. Do you remember this match? In fact, you brought up what I was talking about a month ago, where we had the first blood match, and I got the juice and bled all over you.
Yep.
Do you remember why we did that?
No, I can remember.
Okay, that is the babyface cheating on the heel without actually taking the heat off the heel by getting him busted open. You busted me open. I bled on you. You'd blonde hair back there, and I'd just roll out of the ring and cover my head up, and he said, "Oh, he's bleeding." Then hold the babyface's hand up. Remember that deal?
Yeah.
That was what it was for. So that was the psychology in that 10,000 people, wherever it was at the building or 5,000, wherever we was, and I actually outsmarted you. You busted me open with a gimmick or whatever, and then I get your head and bleed on you, and I just roll out and cover my head up, and the referee says, "Oh, he's bleeding." We bump the ref, he's down, he gets up, sees the juice all over you, and it has nothing to do with you.
Right.
So you and Jamie or Hawk or whoever managed you could come out and say, "No, that's Dan Dundee. He was busted open. We won, blah, blah, blah." Reverse psychology.
Those were a lot of fun days back in the day. So, hey, when are you getting on the road? You circus cranking up here in 2 weeks?
Yeah, about 2 weeks. So we'll be about the 27th of this month. Talking on the road before, my offspring was your manager for a little while. Do you remember them days?
Jamie Dundee, sure do.
I watched the tape the other day. He had a friggin' polka dot suit on, or outfit, a shirt and a pair of pants, black with big yellow dots on it, and you long blonde hair and a robe. I thought, wow. It was just so simple.
It was. We had heat. I didn't know what I was doing, but we had a little bit of heat. It sure was, you know, the training wheels were on, and I was soaking it all in. And again, I was lucky to ride up and down the road, work with you, ride up and down the road with Dutch and Chris Champion. And then when I went back down to Texas, you know, riding up and down the road with Bronco, Skandar, gorgeous Gary Young never got a great break, but he was a very good guy as far as psychology. And he's a journeyman, but a really, really good worker, and could teach what goes on in a squared circle, and he damn sure dropped a lot of information to me. So, man, I go back to those days being some of the most fun of my career.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Steve, and I don't really know how they do it today, but somebody has to like the person. Mark Ruin and I did jobs for them in Australia, and Bobby Shane, they liked me and Barnes. We worked hard. We did whatever they wanted, but they taught us shit. "Well, Mark, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Watch the match. And then you're learning as you're going along. Now, me and you got along good, and we do things, and we were opponent, and I would talk to you, keep you from killing me, but no. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, but I liked you. We got along good, and when you get along good with your opponent, it makes it a whole lot easier. Nobody was really jealous of one another. We just did what we did.
Well, that was a lot of fun. And, hey, man, I appreciate you talking to me today. And, again, I thank you for all the stuff that you helped me with back in the day. It was when I look back at some of those things, I watch I'm critical of the stuff that I did my last few years in business in WWF. But when I watch some of the stuff I watched with you there in that Memphis studio, I just cringe. I'm like, Jesus Christ, that was brutal. So these days when I'm trying to assess some talent that is new in the business, I'm pretty easy on them because I know how green I was, how bad I was, how bad I rushed things. But certainly, you know, I lived, ate, and breathed the business enough so that I could pick it up and, you know, present a hell of a goddamn match and something that you couldn't see through.
Right, but when somebody's telling you, "Well, Steve, you don't do this because," or "you do this because," it makes it a whole lot easier than finding it out a year later.
Yeah, if nobody tells you, "Hey, kid, here's a heads up," you've got to smarten you up.
That's right.
Hey, let's plug your website right now. And the book is If you don't want the answer, don't ask the question. It's Bill Dundee's life story. Let's talk about that website.
It's Bill-Superstar-Dundee-Enterprises.com. And that's the only way you can get it. I sent you one and autographed it for you, right? Yeah. So if you want an autograph, just go to that website, Bill-Superstar-Dundee-Enterprises.com. And you can get T-shirts, DVDs, all kinds of Bill's things. I'm on Twitter at Bill Dundee. And then I'm on Facebook. You can find that. So, and I have a radio show I do every Friday, 11 o'clock to 1. That's on Yahoo Sports, 7:30 a.m. in Memphis, Tennessee, every Friday morning. So,
Bill, I didn't know you were on Twitter. Did you just start this? Because I'm not following you.
Well, okay. Well, I need to see the thing. I mean, Randy Hale helps me with it. I've just kind of started it, too. So, yeah, we're just kind of trying to get me going on it.
Well, welcome to Twitter. Give me that Twitter handle one more time. At Bill Dundee?
Yeah, at Bill Dundee.
Y'all heard him. Follow the man.
Yeah.
Help a brother out.
Yeah, I hear you. Buy the book, Help a Brother Out. You know how that goes, right?
Hey, Bill, be careful traveling down the road. I appreciate you spending an hour and a half with me.
All right. I've really enjoyed it. We have another hour and a half anytime you want it. We've got all kinds of stories. We could probably get a few people divorced, but we'll keep them to ourselves. But that's another story, right?
Well, I'm going to try to get down there to y'all's neck of the woods because I'd love to shoot the breeze with you in person. These Skype calls are what they are, but the magic happens when you got a couple of beers and just shooting a breeze and not trying to cover anything in general. And you know that. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Hey.
And that's how we are.
Yeah, that is how we are. And that's who we are. I appreciate the time, Bill.
All right, Steve. Thank you, man. Appreciate you.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Pluto TV. Need an escape? Drop into Pluto TV for a world of free TV. Stream hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and shows all for free. Yeah, free. No subscriptions, no fees. Imagine 24/7 channels of Narcos, CSI, Star Trek, Survivor, and everything else from hit movies to binge-worthy TV shows, the latest news, live sports, comedy, and more. What are you waiting for? Download the free Pluto TV app for Android, iPhone, Roku, and Fire TV and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.
7 years ago, college wrestler Damien Hurd disappeared from a party in Gunnison, Colorado.
Everyone had been drinking or whatever, the usual party scene.
When, how, and why he left are questions I need your help to understand.
Nobody's heard from him.
No, it's just like he disappeared.
From Cold Case Productions and Podcast One, Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd. I'm your host, Claire Sanima. Join me April 20th for the season premiere.
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
My government name.
Check it out. I host a show called the Big Brother Jake Podcast, and I've taken my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby. Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything. Life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess. But it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.